You are tuned in to a fireside chat with Zany Mystic. Join us now on another exciting metaphysical journey. Relax, tune in, drop out, and take a seat by the fire as we explore new realms and possibilities. This is Magenta Pixie. You can find me at magentapixie.weebly.com. But now, here is Zany Mystic and guest. Enjoy the show.
Greetings, and welcome to a Fireside Chat with Zany Mystic. I'm your host, Lance White. Tonight, my guest is Stephen Bodayan. Stephen is an internationally known author, psychotherapist, and teacher of mindfulness and spiritual awakening. His popular guidebook, Meditation for Dummies, has sold over 250,000 copies worldwide, and his digital program, Mindfulness Meditation, has been praised in the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal. His new book, Beyond Mindfulness, is now available on Amazon.com. Stephen trained for many years as a Buddhist monk and edited the magazine Yoga Journal for a decade. His other books include Buddhism for Dummies and Wake Up Now. You can find him on Facebook under his name and on his website, StephenBodayan.org. And we'll repeat that at the end of the show. So let's welcome him back to the show now. Hi, Stephen. How are you? Well, so how are you?
I'm doing fine, as long as I don't get lost in cyberspace.
Okay, well, good. You come back from the cloud.
Yeah, okay. I'm here. Okay.
Yeah. Well, I really loved your book, Beyond Mindfulness, because it's something that I have felt and pretty much intuited most of my life, that that mindfulness, that awakening requires no effort and struggle and to get someplace or to be something or to do something. And believe me, I've spent many years trying to get someplace, taking courses, doing Vipassana meditation and this and that to gain enlightenment. And the conclusion I came to was that it's already there, and all you have to do is tap into it. So your book is refreshing in that it talks all about how to do that and basically has a lot of exercises to make it simple. So how did you come to the how did you come to write it?
Like many of my books, it was just an inspiration that I felt that this needed to be said. Because, again, I've taught mindfulness for many years. I practiced it as a Buddhist monk. And like you, at a certain point, I realized that it was more of an obstruction than an asset in my awakening process. And so I had to put it aside. Yeah. And then I met a teacher who basically told me to stop meditating and find the meditator. Discover who is meditating, who is the one who is seeking, you know, discover the source of the seeking. And that's when I really woke up. And so I felt that it was important to say this, particularly now, because mindfulness is becoming so popular. It's becoming mainstream, really. Schools, corporations, governments are taking mindfulness as a technique to use to boost productivity and increase workers' efficiency and to help students with their learning and emotional intelligence, which are all wonderful things. I have to say that there's nothing wrong with mindfulness. It has wonderful benefits. It just has certain limitations.
Right. Right. What are the biggest limitations that you see from your perspective?
Well, there are a number of limitations. And I'll kind of run through a few, which are talked about at greater length in the book. One of them is that in the practice of mindfulness, of being mindful of some object, you then really reify the subject-object split. There's always someone meditating, being mindful of something. Mm-hmm. So the subject and the object are constantly separate.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you're aspiring to realize the non-dual nature of existence, which is that subject and object, self and other, are not separate, then this can create a kind of obstacle that's very difficult to overcome.
Mm-hmm.
Because it becomes an ingrained habit. I'm constantly efforting to be mindful, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's hard to let that go. You become a very good mindfulness meditator, and
right.
it's hard to let go of that habit. And the other thing is that it gives you a sense that you have to progress along some path, as you were suggesting, in order to arrive someplace that you aren't already, right?
Right.
There's some future goal. And, you know, not all mindfulness teachers teach in this way. I want to acknowledge there are teachers who teach in a way that suggests that you're not looking for something else that is already present here. But I think the tendency is to want to keep improving and achieving higher and better states rather than returning to your natural state of presence, natural state of awakened awareness, as I call it in the book, which is always already present. You don't have to maintain it. You don't have to create it. You don't have to perpetuate it. As you said, it doesn't require constant effort, right? Another thing is that it can create a kind of spiritual bypassing, a sense of using meditation to avoid facing certain aspects of our lives, you know, certain feelings, certain difficult thoughts and emotions. We can use mindfulness to kind of override those and avoid them, which I think ultimately becomes a trap, because in the fullness of awareness, we're welcoming everything. And if you practice mindfulness in that way, of really fully welcoming everything, then you won't get into that trap. But a lot of times, mindfulness is used in this way to create more separation and to bypass certain aspects of our experience.
Right, and doesn't that also create judgment of certain things, and like the dark side, or you know,
yes.
Your own behavior, and it separates aspects of your existence into layers, which are some are considered good things and some are considered bad. And anything that has a label attached to it is not real. It's just a label.
Well, I think that's a very very good assessment on your part. It shows a real spiritual sophistication. Many people don't really see that. But in the mindfulness tradition, which again, I have to say that I respect and honor the mindfulness tradition. I'm not trying to in any way discount the virtue of mindfulness. But one of the pitfalls is that you're labeling certain mind states as good and other mind states as bad, positive and negative. You're trying to cultivate certain mind states and to avoid other mind states. Now, within a certain frame of reference, that makes a lot of sense. But ultimately, that again is creating a dualism and a kind of a judgment, and it causes us to push away certain aspects of our experience and to overemphasize and to try to maintain through constant effort other aspects of our experience, and it doesn't allow us to fully embrace the fullness of our human experience, you know, because certain things are excluded. So, yes, I agree with what you said.
Well, and then, of course, you've got people who get judgmental about their family or children or whatever not being mindful. And so I could just
right.
hear a mother saying, "Now, be mindful, Johnny. Be mindful."
That's right. That's right. That's exactly right. It can just become another tool for judging oneself, judging others.
Right.
I'm not mindful enough. I'm not being a good enough meditator. I'm not,
right.
you know, living up to... And then you develop a spiritual superego, and you know,
right.
it gets very, very complex. The pitfalls are very subtle and very complex. And again, I think it's great if you start out with mindfulness. I think it's a wonderful place to start. in terms of creating an inner sense of spaciousness, a sense of that you're not identified with your thoughts and feelings anymore. There's a sense of space, of openness. It's a beautiful place to begin, but I think you have to be wary of the pitfalls. Yeah.
So what does awakened awareness, how does one, shall we say, slide into what already is?
Yeah, that's exactly right. How do you fall into, really? It's a matter of falling into what's already the case. You know, sometimes I suggest people do a little exercise, which is to close your eyes,
yeah,
and then open your eyes.
Okay.
And now I want you to decide to be aware of what's in front of you. Okay. Mm-hmm. Now that doesn't make much sense, does it? To decide to be aware of what's in front of you. All you have to do is open. All you have to do is open your eyes, right?
Right.
And awareness is there instantaneously. You don't have to make any effort to be aware. Awareness is your natural state. And when you become aware of awareness, when you become, how shall I say, knowingly aware, that's what I call awakened awareness. It's your resting as awareness. Which is all-inclusive, which embraces everything. There are pointers that I use. Inquiry is a very excellent thing to use. Guided meditations that can be very helpful into inviting us. I call it more an invitation rather than we're making something happen. You're inviting a certain realization or recognition.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, it seems that there was a huge movement for a while to create your own reality. And that was a really pushy, there was a book out, I can't remember what the name of it was, but it was the one that it just sold millions and millions of copies. And it was put together by people who were supposedly had mastered this ability to create your own reality. And so that's become kind of a mantra, too, that that we are active doers and that we need to actually imagine what our day is going to be like and what we're going to do and this and that and the other thing. I thought, that sounds terribly boring. I mean, if you've already figured it all out, then you're just following a script that you just wrote. And there's no room for alterations in that.
Exactly. And then who's in charge, or who thinks that? Who thinks they're in charge? Ultimately, it comes down to the ego is in charge. I think the ego makes a very poor master.
Oh, terrible!
Of circumstances, you know, what you think you want, you know, is it really what you really want, or is it really what's best for the whole? You know, and in any case, we have only a limited control over the circumstances of our lives. You know,
very limited.
Life is a mystery that's constantly unfolding. You know, so it's really more a matter of attuning to the mystery that's unfolding and coming into harmony with that, rather than trying to force our agenda on life. I mean, that's what most of the world thinks is appropriate. I mean, isn't that what conventional reality tells us, you know, the hero myth, being a hero in your own life. I think we have a very limited ability to do that. In any case, it's not the the source of real and abiding happiness.
Mm-hmm. Right, exactly. And then it doesn't include, it leaves out the knowledge or awareness that one is the other also. And that
that's right.
What we do, we to others, we're doing to ourselves. So,
exactly,
it kind of is a carte blanche to do anything you want, as long as you know you get what you want, and
right.
That excludes the other as an object. And I think that what we're talking about is that we are all one, and that you can't, nothing can be separated.
That's right.
And it's all entangled, and then there's the mystery that you were just talking about also has subtle elements that we have to be present to if we want to catch the flavor or the tune into the stations that are more informative. So if we really want to be tuned in by holding an awakened awareness or tuning into that, then we're using our subtle energies. And today, it seems that so many people are having their basic five energies blasted by cell phones and commitments and driving and eating and World War III and what the Illuminati is doing and this and that and the other thing. And so there's no room left for the 362 other senses that are available inform us, which are not loud and blaring. So you can't hear them if there are constant dialogues and constant talking and chatter and movies. And, you know, it's just not possible to tune in to subtle frequencies, is it? I don't think it is. I can't do it.
Well, I think you make a very good point. We're constantly in this whole create your own reality movement. Just gives you the feeling that you can impose your agenda on life, and that's the source of happiness.
Right.
I can say with some authority that you won't find happiness that way. You know, happiness is learning to join the current of life, to let go of separation. And how do you do that? By listening, deeply listening, attuning through, as you say, all the senses, through all the subtle senses, attuning to life and becoming one with the flow of life. Mm-hmm. That's the source of abiding happiness, you know. So it's the exact opposite, actually, of creating your own reality. It's like learning to be the reality that's constantly being created through you.
Right, right.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Right. It's almost like we're instruments, and what we can do is we can align ourselves in different ways so that we can tune into different influences, but it's not that we are the changer or the doer. That's an illusion. It's the ego, basically.
It's the ego, and of course, it doesn't sell very well, because it doesn't appeal to the ego. The ego wants success. It wants accomplishment. It wants approval. It wants love. It wants material possessions.
Yep.
It wants. And any approach that appeals to that craving will be more popular. You know, this approach, which tells you that you're simply a vehicle for life, for the divine, for being to flow through you. I mean, what am I going to get out of that? What's the point? What's the point of that? I mean, what are the fruits of that? You know?
Right.
So you have to. It's an acquired taste, and it's a taste that can be acquired only through a glimpse, really, of this deeper truth, this deeper reality. Once you have a glimpse, then you develop a thirst for living in this way.
You know? Right. Right. Yeah. Right. Now, some of the teachings, I studied Gurdjieff and Ouspensky many years ago, and according to Gurdjieff, part of creating a permanent I or master was creating a separate observing I, and then that observing I becomes transforms or morphs into the master when it becomes when you're permanently observing yourself and dividing attention between what you see and yourself, so that you're aware of yourself as you look out, and that's also an arrow coming back in. But in your book, there is no creation of an external being or entity, is there? I think you
yeah
talk about
yeah,
that one. chapters.
Yeah, I think, again, that that approach that you're describing, if I understand it correctly, runs the risk of, again, creating a separation that's very difficult to overcome. Creating the observing ego, creating the witness, you know, even the notion of the witness. You know, it's very hard once you become this so-called witness. You develop this kind of detachment from life as if you're looking on life from above, you know, from this perch above. And there's something seductive about it and can feel very safe in a certain way, satisfying. But it's very difficult to undo that and come back into the complete intimacy and the dissolution of the sense of separation. So the way I teach is not to develop the observing ego or the witness, but actually to dissolve from the very beginning. Because, you know, even the mindfulness tradition, it's teaching you to develop the witness in order to ultimately dissolve the witness. I mean, that's the ultimate goal. But, you know, from the tradition that I come from, why do you want to even bother to do that? Most of us already have a witness. That's very, very well developed. In fact, in our society, that's something that's highly valued. You know, this observing ego. You know, the sense of detachment. In other cultures, perhaps traditional cultures, you needed to develop that first. In our culture, that's already well developed. So we can begin, you know, from the beginning. In the work that I do and that I offer is for people to learn to dissolve the boundaries. You know, to discover that sense of openness and spaciousness beyond the mind, beyond the body, which is always already present. You know, just to tap into that directly. You don't need to develop the witness. Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. I love that. And there were some exercises that you were, the simple ones that are easy to follow quickly, you know, and do quickly, which I like because I have a short attention span, allow you to be outside your body and yet to experience the rest of it. And one of the things that I do periodically when I want to feel an expanded reality is I use my creative imagination to put myself into the space in which the matter that forms my body and my house and the stars and everything resides in. So I just shift my attention to the space, and then I am that. And then that gives me a different perspective on all the rest of this stuff.
So
that's kind of a fun thing to do.
Yes, that makes sense. I mean, again, that is what we're talking about here, is a shift. And it's a fundamental shift in one's sense of who one is, and that's what spiritual awakening is, and that's what the book, of course, is about. It's a shift from identifying with a particular limited, fixated point of reference to identifying with life itself, with the whole, you know, with infinite spaciousness, right? And once you realize that, it's hard to go back. You know, it's hard to get lost again in the fixated, limited point of reference. I mean, you can come back into it, but you can never forget who you really are. So that shift is really crucial. And that's a lot of the work I'll do in workshops and retreats and things like that, is to invite that shift, that opening, that sudden awakening to the ground, to the space, you know, which is, we take for granted. We take space, we take awareness for granted. You know, I tell the story in the book of the famous story of Nasruddin, the holy Sufi fool who used to go across the border with donkeys with baskets on their back and forth, and the border guards could never figure out what he was smuggling, you know. And then one day after Nasruddin is retired, he meets one of the border guards and he says, "Well, Nasruddin, what were you smuggling?" And he looks at him and he says, "You know, I was smuggling donkeys." You know, so we don't pay attention to the donkeys. We don't pay attention to awareness. Awareness is our natural state. It's without awareness, nothing would be.
Yeah.
There'd be no experience without awareness. And yet we're so focused on experience that we forget awareness. It's the air that we breathe. It's the space through which we move. It's the water that the fish moves through. We couldn't live without awareness. So we have to awaken to awareness itself. That's what awakened awareness is. Discovering our identity with awareness itself.
Now, how does awareness relate to the idea of consciousness? Do you get into that at all as far as the different states of consciousness?
I would say that awareness and consciousness are the same.
Okay.
Yeah. Of course, there are different states of awareness. I mean, clearly, we go through different states throughout the day, right?
Oh, absolutely. We're
constantly going through states, right? You know, in the book, I say we're not talking in the work that I do with people. We're not talking about going to an altered state. We're talking about actually coming back to our natural state. So we cycle through all these different states. But what is the fundamental ground beneath all the states, prior to all the states? What is that? That's what we're looking for. That's what we're looking to awaken to. You know, it's like states are made of something, right? What is that? Yeah. What is the substance? What is that ineffable, ungraspable substance out of which all states are composed, right?
Yeah. Well, it sure seems that having a child's eyes is a part of that, because that natural curiosity is present, and when I'm in a state of awareness of things, there are no questions and there's no judgment.
That's
right. There's just the awe of everything as if it was all new.
That's right. That's right. Exactly. And this is called, in Zen, it's called beginner's mind, right?
Yeah, right. You're right. Of course.
And beginner's mind is equated with the mind of the great Zen masters. So beginner's mind is where we begin, but it's also where we end up. That's what I mean.
Right.
That's what I mean by our natural state. It's what we return to. My teacher used to say, and it was actually the phrase that woke me up, really, he said, the seeker is the sought. The looker is what he or she is looking for. Right.
Right. I like that. That was really powerful.
Yes.
I had to read that part several times to do my own internal flip-flop with it.
Exactly. A flip-flop is exactly what's being called for. Yeah.
Well, you know, maybe they should have called beginner's mind ender's mind, because here we take everything so literally that we think, okay, well, if this is beginner's mind, I've got a long way to go.
Exactly. Well, in the Tibetan tradition, they talk about what's called ground, path, and fruition.
Okay.
The fruition is the end result. You know, it's the ender's mind. It's where you end up. But ultimately, the fruition and the ground, which is where you begin, are identical.
Mm.
So you begin at the ground, you go along the path, you end up with fruition. And when you realize fruition, you realize that where you ended up was where you began.
Mm. Well, now, how does an awareness of one's death and mortality play into this? I know many people who go through near-death experiences or out-of-body experiences as well seem to be altered, and they're more present and awake to what's going on. They sometimes even have more abilities in various psychic areas.
Yes.
How important is it to make peace with ourselves and with death? Because we seem to be in a state of denial about that will ever happen.
Exactly. I mean, death is very much a part of the Buddhist tradition that I was schooled in. You know, they have all kinds of meditations on death, and you know, the life path from certain Buddhist traditions is the preparation for death. You know, because when you die, the idea is that you have the opportunity to fully release yourself and achieve ultimate liberation, you know. So death is a great teacher. Without death, if we didn't have death, if we lived forever, we wouldn't be motivated to do spiritual practice. We wouldn't be motivated to inquire and to wake up, right? Death
right.
is, in that sense, the great motivator, the great teacher. The great motivator for me on my path was the death of my mother when I was 15. So in a certain way, death was the beginning of my path. Yeah.
Was there something particular that she said or did?
No, no, just the fact that I had lost the person I was closest to.
Suddenly,
at the age of 15, it was like, oh my God, you know, I was faced with the abyss, right?
Wow.
When you lose someone who's close to you, especially at a young age, you know, you're faced with the abyss with, okay, now what? What is real? What is true?
Right. Where did she go? Is she alive? Where am I? Who am I?
You got it.
Yeah, that is troubling.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
There's another thing that was crossing my mind, and that was, I think Buddha was, this is one of the things that I got from whatever I've read through about the subject, and that is that it's really the way of non-attachment, that it's walking through life without attaching to anything. And, of course, that is a tight wire act, but
right.
it doesn't mean that you could swing far to the right, you could swing far to the left, but in general, you are ending up walking the middle path by not attaching to anything. And I think many people would like to know that they're not returning over and over and over through myriad incarnations because they were so attached to some particular aspect of their lives that they have to come back and re-experience it. I know I don't want to really come back and do that.
Right, right. Yeah, I mean, that's one way to look at it. I mean, I'm rather an agnostic about future lives or past lives. I mean, it may or may not be true. But, you know, I haven't experienced any. Some people
right.
say they have, so, you know, I certainly honor that. But, right. You know, you don't need past lives to or future lives to motivate you, you know, to right. not be attached. Because even in this life, attachment brings suffering. You know?
Right.
It's pretty straightforward, you know. In a certain way, you could say we're being reborn moment after moment.
Uh-huh.
And in each new lifetime, which means each new moment,
right.
there's the potential to suffer as the result of our attachment, right? When we get attached
yeah.
and things are taken from us, right, we
yeah.
suffer, right?
Right?
So it doesn't mean not to care, but it means not to fixate, not to attach, right?
Right. And then, of course, that releases us from judgment and suffering and a lot of painful emotions that could occur that are not real.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
right.
That's the
exactly.
funny thing about them is when you wake up and you're having an emotion and you realize that it's just kind of a fake emotion, that it was caused by an attachment, it's almost humorous sometimes.
Yeah, well, that's the process of freeing yourself moment after moment, which means seeing through the nature of what's arising, right? And
mm-hmm.
that's what you're talking about, seeing that the emotion that's coming up, which you take to be so real and which
yeah.
you may attach to, is actually caused by a set of thoughts, which are themselves just a fabrication and don't have much to do with reality. But that
right, right.
That kind of insight takes a tremendous ability to stay present and to inquire, you know, and that's something that develops over time. And no doubt you've, you know, spent years doing this, you know, as have I, but just to begin to, first to be aware of the thoughts and feelings and then to start wondering about them. You know, is this reality or is this just my perception of reality, right? I mean, the greatest attachment most people have is to their thoughts, to their beliefs, to their stories. You know, we're all attached to our story, to our identity.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Oh, yes.
So,
oh, yes.
Yeah.
And belief systems can become very hard structures within the mind that one cannot navigate out of. You're basically the more structures you create with belief systems, the more you nail your feet to the floor and you can't see anything except that. And
right.
that sets you up against everything else that is not that. So it's a
right.
it's really a tricky wicket.
That's a good way to put it. That's right. By getting firmly entrenched in your opinions, in your belief system, you set yourself up in opposition to everything and everyone who doesn't agree with you. And
exactly.
that just creates more separation and creates more suffering. And of course, we see this in the world. I mean, nationalism, fundamentalism, it's all around us.
Mm-hmm.
And the suffering that that creates, you know, belief systems that are shared by a whole nation or a whole religion or a whole culture.
And then, of course, there are beings or people that are attempting to create all kinds of belief systems constantly because belief systems get us to buy things and to become consumers, the consumers that we've
right.
been programmed to become.
Right.
And so once we get onto the treadmill of consumption, that's just an endless path of fractals that you can go down and until you've spent yourself to death.
Right, right. And all of it really has to do with what people think will make them happy.
Right.
You know, really. When you get to the bottom of all of this, it's because people believe that this will make me happy. Consumerism will make me happy. Fundamentalism will make me happy. Nationalism will make me happy. A relationship will make me happy.
Uh-huh.
You know, a career will make me happy. You know, all of these things outside of ourselves. We believe
mm-hmm.
the story that we're fed, the beliefs that we're fed about all of that. And, you know, most of the people in our lives also share those beliefs. So there's a lot of support in believing that, which is why, you know, teachings and books of like the kind I write are so important because they offer an alternative worldview, right?
Mm-hmm.
That people can turn to, instead of what they're being fed by media or by religions or you know cultures. Yeah,
absolutely. I watched a movie last night. I don't usually watch movies this violent, but it was called World War Z.
Oh, right.
It was basically a zombie movie.
Right.
But I thought, gee, this is really boring. But I watched it to the end because I wanted to get my 70 cents worth from Netflix. And I realized that it was a propaganda piece for vaccinations. That it was all about getting vaccines, and that the World Health Organization is there to help you, and that without them, these vaccinations would be, mankind would be doomed. And I've been reading a lot of material on what's really in vaccinations, and that they're very harmful, that they can cause autism, they have mercury, and this and that. So there are some factors involved here that, are coming into play, and these movies that we watch are filled with violence, and that is going to create a reaction within us, and then they're filled with propaganda
yes.
as well. So,
mm-hmm.
you know, if we're not present and aware of what's going on, you know, we're just not going to know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, here again, awareness, presence, is so powerful, so important. Yeah, I have to say I turned that movie off. Too violent for me. I just couldn't do it. Yeah.
I should have. Had I been a little more awake at the moment, I would have just... But I mean, it seems much more soothing and gentle to walk outside and commune with nature and listen to the wind.
Exactly.
Or to listen to the sound of water over the rocks, or hugging a tree, or talking to a bird or something. You know, I mean, those things are much more enjoyable than watching zombies.
Right. Absolutely.
And
also nature is a powerful teacher, because if we spend time in nature and attune to nature, it's teaching us about no separation, you know, because nature, you know, there is no separation in nature, actually. It's just one continuum, right? So if we really, and we can lose ourselves in nature, we can, the boundaries so much more easily dissolve in nature, and we can feel ourselves at one with reality. So being in nature, even if it's just a little city park, is a wonderful invitation. Yeah.
Well, and it's funny, too, that when we make the effort to do that, that nature will respond in strange ways, because there's this vast intelligence that is in all things, in a butterfly, in an ant, and sometimes I'll just be sitting outside just admiring that, and something will just come along, some insect or a bird or something, and I'll sense this enormous intelligence and communication, and I feel like, you know, I'm the dumb one because I have all these thoughts and belief systems. And it's just being, and I can get it. I mean, I'm getting its intelligence, and it's communicating.
Beautiful.
And I love it when that happens.
Beautiful. Exactly. Yeah.
Well, you know, some people travel into the forest just to have that experience without Wi-Fi and without any cables, and they'll go into, I've had some of my guests talk about going into the forest, deep into the forest, and they say that the trees literally talk to them and move as they're walking through them. They describe magical realms that we only know about from our fairy tales as children. Mm-hmm. But that is reality, and that's what, you know, there is that life and essence and the spirit of things, you know, the devas and elementals and life forms that come alive and can communicate when you're in the, when you're able to receive. So
there are different ways of communing with nature. You know, of course, I don't come from the school of devas, you know, but I certainly bow again to that tradition. But you know, even with or without devas, there's certainly a sense of you know, just a oneness that one can experience so readily in nature, and a sense of a presence, an abiding presence that permeates everything, you know? Awareness is not limited to here.
Right.
Consciousness or awareness permeates all of reality. It's the essence of everything, you know?
Yeah.
And in nature, we can feel that silent presence beneath and through everything so much more easily than we can, you know, in our workaday world, you know. Being in nature, you know, to go for a walk, you know, every now and then in nature is a wonderful gift. Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Absolutely. Well, you know, scientists are finding that if you stimulate an electron or a quark in one spot, well, 100,000 light years away, or, you know, however far away, it will, its twin or its counterpart will instantly experience the same state. So that kind of indicates that, you know, we are in something, or we are all of something that is instantaneously communicating, and that the speed of light is just like glasses dripping out of a jar.
Yeah, absolutely. Instantaneous, yeah. I mean, there's no separation in the heart, you know?
Right.
But, yeah. So, the communion is happening constantly, you know, through all of it constantly, you know, through all of reality constantly. There, again, no separation. If there's no separation, then, you know, it's, and to attune to that, to be able to attune to that, as you were saying, to really listen to reality, to listen to life. My teacher, Jean Klein, used to use the word listening, not only to talk about the sense of hearing, but to talk about being present for life as it unfolds. You know, it's a beautiful metaphor, just to listen, you know? Yeah.
Well, you know, we're so used to thinking about what we're going to say next. that we have forgotten how to listen.
Right.
And conversations really require an effort, because when the other person is talking, then technically I would be making an effort to hear you and to take in what you're saying and understand it. And I would just be listening, and there would be an exchange. But it does seem that most dialogues are monologues.
Yes, that's true. Yeah, and to really, when you listen to others, to just set aside all agenda, all preconceptions, need to respond, all defensiveness, set it aside and just be completely open, which is a great way to be in every moment. In every situation, but particularly with others, just to be completely open. Let it just wash through you. Don't even try to conceptualize it or understand it. Let it wash through you, and then allow a response to arise from the depths of your being rather than through your mind. Let it bypass your mind.
Yeah.
Go into your heart, go into your body, and allow rather than, formulate a response, allow a response.
Well, I love that, and that's how we really get somebody else.
That's right.
Somebody's been God, to receive.
That's right, and we also desperately want to be received. I think the greatest, if I could say, the greatest thing that most people want, and of course I work with people as a therapist and a counselor, as a teacher, people so desperately want to be heard, received, seen, just as they are. And when they're in the presence of someone who sees them that way, they feel so relieved and so opened, right? Mm-hmm. It allows a movement, a shift to take place. So if we can do that for one another, that's a profound gift,
Beautifully said. In fact, whoever's listening to this tonight, try it with somebody that you're talking to tonight. Just try to do what we just mentioned. Get to hear and let the other person just kind of flow through you and just get them without judgment or thoughts or, just get them.
I can guarantee you that if you allow that to happen, what's going to arise is love.
Oh, yes. Yeah. That seems to be the place where that's the spot. That hits the spot.
Exactly.
Well, Stephen, we're almost out of time. It seems like it just flew by. I love talking to you, and I love your book, Beyond Mindfulness. And I recommend it to everybody to use as a tool constantly. Before we sign off, would you make sure that people know where to find you, and with your websites and your Facebook site?
Yes, thank you very much, Lance. It's been a pleasure to talk with you. Yeah, my website is Stephen Bodian, that's STEPHANBODIAN .org or .com, whatever, you can use either one. And my Facebook site is Facebook/Stephen Bodian, the same. And, I have regular blog posts in which I offer teachings, and there's some recorded material available on my website, so I highly recommend that you go and check it out.
Wonderful. Well, thank you again, Stephen, for returning for our second show. And I'll probably talk to you again in the future.
Well, thanks very much for having me, Lance. It's really been a pleasure.
It's my pleasure.
Yeah, take good care. Namaste.
Namaste.